Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, this is Feed Your Head, and I'm Ms. Anna Marte Fio, and my guest is Scott Rickard. Hello, Scott.
Hello, how are you?
I am great. How are things down in Florida?
It's pretty exciting here. You got the 4th of July going on. You got a lot of people running around. We were on the beach watching fireworks last night. We came to another part of the beach where they're launching tonight, so it's Independence Day. Independence Day, but I don't think we've had our independence here for over 150 years, unfortunately.
Thank you. That's what people said, well, how are you celebrating? And I said, well, I'm not celebrating. We don't have independence to celebrate. I love fireworks, so,
yeah.
You know, I can go along with that, I suppose. But, you know, when I was a kid, oh, I love the 4th of July. And even when I was an adult, I mean, before I actually had my eyes open, you know, it meant something. And then I found out that everything that I thought it meant was pretty much lies. So,
yeah. When did you find that out for yourself?
Oh, it's not been, I mean, it was a gradual thing. I was one of those people with my head stuck up my butt.
Yeah, we all were.
You know, denial, it's a rough one. I mean, there were things about the government I didn't like, but I kept thinking that there was some kind of good and some wisdom. And then I found out, you know, those people are the farthest thing from wise that we have put in office in our country. And that sort of, well, that's what some of our whistleblowers have been trying to put the word out on.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I had kind of a similar experience back in the late 80s that William Binney and Edward Snowden and same thing with Bradley Manning. You know, it's one thing to blow the whistle on something you don't like. You know, that I probably don't agree with. But if you're blowing the whistle on something that's illegal, for sure, you know, that's what I think, that's the right thing to do. And many of my colleagues at the time, we did it, but we did it anonymously, and we sent things to the Department of Justice, and unfortunately those were just swept under the rug. So
okay. I was going to ask if they were acted upon. And you're talking like late 80s, before we really had the advent of the internet and things weren't as public.
Well, Before the people had the internet. The government had the internet at that time.
After the government had, since what, 50s or something? The government has had the internet. And I guess if it wasn't for whatever they did back then, we may not have it, at least to the degree we do now. So, you know.
Sure. Most people would be surprised. The government had internet in the 60s. It was a little arcane, but they were bouncing signals off the sun, off the moon, excuse me, to basically communicate around the world before they had satellites.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of, the government had an endless budget for a long time, and they still do.
I was going to say, they still do.
I mean,
it goes
for
war, but they've got the budget. I've heard that, or I saw it recently, read something. They were talking about whistleblowers. They said, as a rule, they're really loyal to the organization they're working for or with, but their ethics come in conflict because they think morally what this organization is doing is wrong, and then that's why they whistleblow. Then the organization feels betrayed. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people within the organization, maybe the institution might feel betrayed, but a lot of people agree with a lot of the decisions that are made by some of these whistleblowers. You know, there's many, many folks in the military and the government agree with Daniel Ellsberg. I know a lot of people that agree with William Binney. I knew William when he was a lad in the 80s, basically just installing Ethernet across the NSA. And we were deploying some of the first office automation platforms and using those, way before, basically the public really didn't start using those kind of platforms until the 90s. And the early 90s, and the platforms that they were using were, far less, I would say, connected and coordinated. The government had a much better communications capability, and they're always about 10 years ahead of what they release into the public. So, William actually saw the systems being built that were recording all of our phone calls. And they kind of skirted around the fact that, they're just recording the actual sources and destinations and basically running analysis against the originating and the receiving ends. But the facts are is that they can actually record billions of minutes a day. And they are building one of the largest IT centers in Utah, and that's not by. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that new storage center in Utah is supposed to just have capability of storing forever.
They want to store 100 years of calls, basically. The thing is that storage center that's not being built in Utah by accident. Something that the American people don't understand is that a lot of the intelligence community is actually very well managed by the Mormon Church. But the Mormon Church has been very involved in the American government as well as the intelligence community for two main reasons. Originally, it was around the Silver Rush. When the silver rush went on in the 1800s, most of the silver was mined in Utah, and every single mine was owned by the Mormon Church. And the difference between silver and gold in value at the time, it was minute compared to what the difference is today. Gold is a far... Yes?
No. I didn't know that. Okay.
No, most Americans are very unaware of this. And the other issue is the majority of linguists at the National Security Agency, which does has probably the best intelligence linguists in the world, come out of the Mormon Church because they're very aggressive with their missionary work around the world, and so they have a lot of language programs in Provo. At the at Brigham Young, so there's and part of their program as graduates are to go on international missions to promote the Mormon Church. So and because they don't use drugs and drink alcohol or even coffee, it's very likely that they'll pass their security background check.
Right.
So they have a very and they're excellent workers. I mean, I had 80% of my office were Mormon individuals when I worked in a specific anti-terrorism organization in the 80s, and it was pretty evident. You know, these guys ran the office, and back 30 years ago, so you can imagine they all stayed with the system, and they're all in management today. And needless to say, they're all very much driven by the Scofield Reference Bible. So they all have Jesus on speed dial for Armageddon. So,
Right. So. Yeah, but now when you were what you were saying, I lived in Idaho for quite a while, and there were a lot of Mormons, and we would go to Utah, more Mormons, and I really like the Mormons. I like their work ethic, the whole family thing. So I can see how they would be valued employees.
Oh, absolutely, and they don't question authority at all.
That's another thing right there, and I think they're pretty patriotic.
Absolutely, yeah. They believe if you look at the history of the founder, he used to preach that when a Mormon became president of the United States, that Jesus would return, and it would be the beginning of Revelations.
Ah.
So they all believe, and many of them believe, that if Romney was elected, that it would be the beginning of Revelations and the return of Christ. So
well, yes, men. So.
I know many that won't admit it publicly, but they certainly do believe it.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I have a friend who's Mormon, and there's certain things that he just chooses not to talk about online, and he'll send me things. He doesn't want to talk about it. Yeah,
it's a very private church, and the beginnings of it. If you do any history on the beginnings of it, it has a very precarious beginning, and it rose to such prominence, in my opinion, due to the Silver Rush, and if you look at basically the size of the church versus the wealth of the church, that's not all coming from tidings, because there's never been that much industry in any of the Utah cities. Now it's much better than it used to be, but certainly not the numbers that you look at the size of the tabernacles and check into any Marriott hotel and pull the drawer open next to the bed, there's a Book of Mormon in there. Not a lot of people realize it, that the Mormons own the Marriott Church as well.
The chain?
I call it the Marriott Church.
because used to have Gideon Bibles around. I've read the Book of Mormon. I've read a lot of different things. But so if they are, like you say, one of the prime, at least they were, and now probably even more so, what do I want to call them? Well, they're snoops,
there are some of the most prominent individuals in the intelligence community, mm-hmm. Especially in numbers, because of the kind of recruiting that went on and still goes on out of the actual linguists that are coming out of Brigham Young, and now with the advent of this giant center going into Utah, for me that's a telltale. That's not a coincidence.
Now that makes sense. I just did not know about the silver mining, but
yes.
Since that it makes sense then that they would have owned it, the mine, so of course.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's interesting the things that you find if you go looking for them. I found a proclamation from the 1800s and the early part of the gold rush in California. There was a lot of resistance from the indigenous Indians and. Because the British were financing the gold rush, the British actually helped fund this proclamation that gave 40 pounds sterling for every Californian scalp that was turned in for about a year. And it wiped out half of the Californian Indian population. But those particular details were never in my Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of things that didn't make it into the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oddly enough, as Americans, we were all raised on the Encyclopedia Britannica, not the Encyclopedia Americanica.
Yeah, funny, huh? But
yeah,
well,
it sounds kind of strange, doesn't it?
But I think back to the history books that were in the schools I was in, and I'm just appalled at the downright lies and then just everything that was left out.
Oh,
so,
certainly. When I was a senior in high school, I wrote these incredibly positive essays about this fantastic president I learned about called Lyndon Johnson. And what a fool.
Good for you, Scott.
turns out what an ass that guy was.
Oh, but no, we believed this stuff. And
we sure did.
We believed. We had not discovered what real truth was at the time.
Well, and the sad part about that is, you know, here I am now. I'm in my, you know, mid to late 20s. I'm working at NSA, and I'm finally starting to see it. And I've already spent, you know, nearly a decade in the intelligence community. So coming from that context and taking that long to wake up, you know, imagine the guy that never gets into that that sort of stream of information. It may never wake up.
Right. I mean, then that's the rest of us. And then that's where the Internet comes in and people like you who are willing to speak out. And then the whistleblowers we have now, I think the most famous names right now would be Bradley Manning, Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden. But they aren't by any means the only ones. And you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg earlier, because I've heard Bradley Manning compared to him and WikiLeaks compared to the Washington Post.
Well, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg even said himself that he believed that, you know, he wasn't persecuted, you know, and was treated, because he almost went to jail as well, but they dropped the case because they had, you know, basically mistreated him. Now, he said he cannot believe how much they mistreated Daniel Ellsberg. Now, the huge difference is Daniel Ellsberg was in the military, and, you know, albeit what he did was right, what he did was also illegal. And so I'm very, impressed by what he did. And I think rather than just focusing on the illegalities, I think, which is what the government does, they haven't focused on what he did that was right. And I think that that's completely irresponsible and incredibly corrupt. Because the fact is that he did expose war crimes. He did expose something that was illegal, and nobody has been held accountable. And the same goes for Snowden. And, you know, I think Assange, you know, I mean, I have to say, obviously he was more of a channel for information.
Yes.
And
yes.
Where he got that information and who fed that information to him. The problem is that, you know, even myself, I've been co-opted by what I consider to be CIA operations. I've done some interviews I'm a little bit skeptical of the people conducting the interviews. One was out of Beirut, and it was an Iraqi television station broadcasting on three different satellites out of Beirut. Now, first of all, Iraqi television stations aren't doing much without a lot of American fingers in that pie. Secondly, operating out of Beirut, okay, now you know there's got to be some American fingers in that pie.
No, that even to me that sounds just shall we say a bit bizarre.
But that is the case. I mean, you have, you know, the media controls the mind, and not many people look into it to see where it comes from. I mean, this even happened to me way beyond here. I'm leaving, you know, after realizing that my government is doing just incredibly criminal stuff, and I go to work at NASA here in Florida, and when I'm down here, I'm, you know, kind of, you know, enamored by the media. I mean, I've got things like, you know, obviously CNN and, you know, the Gulf War. And then you've got this emerging Al Jazeera that everybody believes is the cat's meow because it's, you know, a voice from the Arabs. But then as time went on, I learned, wait a second, Al Jazeera owned by the emir. you know, this guy's spending $50 million a year out of his own pocket. And by the way, it's the headquarters for the U.S. and the U.K.'s operation in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And, So Qatar is, it turns out, and thank God they had some reporters with their conscience, but it turns out during the Libyan and the Syrian invasions by NATO and its Arab puppet state allies, that over a dozen reporters basically quit working for Al Jazeera because of its disingenuous reporting that they were being forced to do. So, you know, that was, hopefully, not many people see it, though, because, you know, as much as you and I talk about it, you know, we're kind of in an echo chamber. You know, we all hear it. But at the end of the day, the average American is still watching 35 hours of television a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, and not a lot of that is news. So, you know, and even if it is news, they're being misinformed.
Well, that's it. Even, I mean, it just as well not be news, because the news, it's not the truth, or at least not the whole.
Well, Dancing with the Stars doesn't make them any smarter either.
Yeah. Well, reality shows aren't doing much for this country. Let's get real.
That's for sure.
I dumped my TVs several years ago, and I don't miss them.
Good idea.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm at friends and they have it on, or I'll flip around in the middle of the night, get RT on or something, or some other country's news. And true, online, I mean, I go to Press TV quite a bit. I do Al Jazeera, several, but I get news from the Philippines and Kashmir and some different places, too, because you know, you have to check around. You just can't.
Yeah, and you're not going to get it on your remote control. You've got to get online to find that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the problem is that only about 10% of those 35 hours of television programming are online.
Wow.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. Because you think there would be more.
That's why I call it the echo chamber. And you know, and the funny part about it, you know, if you look at the amount of, you know, like there's a billion hits right now on RT for its channel on YouTube, which is by far, it exceeds NBC, it exceeds CBS, ABC, CNN, all the American channels. You got a Russian television network that basically has a billion hits. Now, that should tell you something. You know, people are looking for information.
That's what, I mean, I laugh at myself sometimes because, I find myself, RT, Al Jazeera, Press TV, whatever, and I just laugh that I'm checking around there to find out what's going on in my own country.
Well, you say that, but you know what's been really interesting is that I've been super lucky to gotten a little attention from the folks at Press TV, and I've probably done over at least 60 to 70 appearances on their radio programs. Not really; it's just a little 5-minute interview, but also some debate programs. I've debated some people where I've learned about American history by the people that they put me up against because I do a little research on these people. And then I've also learned a lot about some of the activists in this country because you probably are familiar with Isobar out of Chicago, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's his first name?
I know who you're talking about, but I'm not that familiar, so I don't.
He's an anti-war activist, and he's fantastic, and he operates, I can't remember his name, and I feel guilty about that. But super guy, and I was on a program with him, and I'd never heard of him. And then they also put me on a program once out of Tehran against a guy named George Lambrakis. Well, George Lambrakis, it turns out, was writing State Department reports for Dean Rusk, and they also wrote the reports during the 6-day war when the U.S. was covering up the USS Liberty, event. Yes, and he was in the embassy in Tel Aviv, writing the communications for the State Department, sending it back to Dean Rusk for Dean Rusk to communicate out to the rest of the State Department. So he was architecting the cover up. So I get put in a debate with this guy. Well, now these days he's in London, maybe not American. He may be Greek. He may even be, I haven't been able to figure this out, but he may even be related to Grigoris Lambrakis, which is a very significant character from the 50s in Greece when the Americans put a military puppet government in place. And he was a senator in the government that was coming up in the 50s and basically... basically was assassinated by the military dictatorship that we put in place because he was anti-imperialist and he was against the NATO occupation of Greece and also the military dictatorship, and he was gaining a lot of momentum with the public, and then he was assassinated in the middle.
Right, he had to die.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a great movie called Z that came out. And it's a French movie, and it's a fantastic movie that documents that quite well. So it's just, you know, a lot of these things, unfortunately, you know, we're not taught in our high schools or our colleges, and unless you're a digger, unless you're, you know, looking at, you know, sort of the anti-imperialist movements of the early 1900s or throughout the 20th century, you know, you're not going to find this stuff. And there hasn't been a whole lot of, you know, probably the most incredible success in the United States was maybe Martin Luther King in my lifetime, you know, and look what they did to him, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had to use the religious community in order to gain that kind of momentum, because that was his, he was able to take advantage of the actual Christian community to get people together. Otherwise, you know, as left and right parties, we are, you know, at each other's throats with pure ambiguity. So, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to American politics at this point.
Oh, no, but we've got the Uniparty, sometimes called Republicans and Democrats. And then,
pretty much. That's 90% of our country.
And then there's the far-left radicals who...
Well, I wouldn't even call myself a radical anymore. I mean, I would have probably a year or two ago, but there's so many of us, like, that they've had to actually... They've actually modified the social networking platform so it's harder for us to grow our rank. There's a program that, because Facebook is probably the most prolific social networking platform to date, they've written a program called EdgeRank. What EdgeRank does is that it makes sure that if you and I aren't talking on Facebook, you'll never see anything I post on your newsfeed. But if we're having a dialogue all the time, if we're poking each other or sending each other messages or... we're talking back and forth to each other on our timelines, or maybe within groups, then we see a lot more of what we're each other are doing, and we'll see the other people's posts and our news feeds and our notifications. So that's one of the ways. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there's something I think that I read that there's about 250 people. There again, that, you know, if you do have some type of contact with them, who show up on your news feed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the chances of you getting something if you're not talking to somebody on a fairly frequent basis, like you said, you're not going to hear anything. You've got to go to their page and see.
You've got to go to their pages. So it's And then I've also noticed that, you know, very controversial things are deleted if you go back and review other people's pages and yours. So there's and the also the timelines and the lifespans of your posts. You know, it's interesting because it is a form of what I consider 21st century censorship. You know,
it's censorship. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I've been very lucky with Press TV. They've brought me on several programs talking about censorship, and you know, it's incredible that we have, you know, satellite censorship against, you know, basically Iranian television has been targeted now for almost a year.
Yeah.
And you have, yeah, and they've taken them out of Europe. They just pulled them off of Intelsat July 1st. I mean, this is, you know, what I consider a prelude to war.
Right. I believe Africa, because they just posted recently something on how to get Press TV if you're in Africa. Because, yeah, they've this censorship is amazing. I have messages in my personal messages in Facebook that are deleted.
Oh, really?
And,
wow.
Yeah. And it's not on a regular basis, but, you know, I'll talk to somebody, and then it's like I didn't hear from them, or I want to add something, so a couple days later I go back, and that particular message is gone. I mean, they're waiting for my answer kind of thing. So I don't
know. What happens sometimes, this does happen to me too. I've had people that have belonged to groups, and it appears when the group has a post that is considered, I guess, hate speech or some sort of something that causes the group to be blocked or something like that for some reason, any of the administrators of those groups, their accounts become immediately suspended. And when they're suspended, all of their messages are deleted from your message feed.
Mm.
But I've seen that several times. So that's, you know, is that another form of censorship? Who knows? I mean, it depends on in the hands of whom. I mean, you know, who's actually making the decision on, you know, shutting down groups and if it's specific administrators. You know, so I try to avoid being administrators on specific groups. Because, you know, I don't want to be shut down, like,
exactly.
You know. But at the same time, I kind of get the feeling, because I've gone out of my way to build sort of a very wide variety network of individuals, that it's you know, a government looks for honeypots. And I would consider, you know, the kind of connectivity and conversations that I have to be kind of, I mean, several of the guys I communicate with are former Pakistani intelligence. They're, you know, a lot of really great journalists around the world, some incredible, you know, really well-educated individuals. I mean, it's, and I've done it, you know, pretty methodically over the past few years by reading articles, finding out who's involved, and going after, you know, the individual that wrote the article or who they wrote about or those types of things in a real stalking manner. You know, not aggressive, but certainly looking for connectivity. And one of the most interesting stories I ran across was a young man named Nicholas Schmeidel. Nicholas Schmeidel was the guy who broke the Osama bin Laden takedown story. When he was taken down, apparently or allegedly, in a lot of that.
Say something about that, okay? Allegedly, all right.
Allegedly, I would say, and well, I mean, you know, they certainly didn't give us very good evidence. So my point is that the story was broke by Nicholas Schmeidel. Well, I went and did a little research and found out who this young man was. Well, it turns out that Nicholas Schmeidel, graduating college in 2002, somehow ends up in Pakistan working for an NGO that's funded by the government, so it's kind of an oxymoron, a non-government organization funded by the U.S. government.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, and his job while he was there, a guy who had no experience in Urdu or Pashto or any kind of linguistic skills, is supposedly writing situation reports on the different tribes. Well,
yeah.
Obviously, he's a mouthpiece for other people that might know something about the language or might be trying to manipulate his materials. Well, in 2009, Nicholas Schmeidel is kicked out of Pakistan on suspicion of espionage. Well, his first job that he lands when he comes back to Washington, D.C., is at the New America Foundation. So the New America Foundation is a think tank built by Google to basically liaison with the government on how to collect intelligence on cyberspace.
So I'd say that the Pakistani government was pretty right on.
They were pretty right on. And needless to say that Nicholas Schmeidel's father, General, four-star General Schmeidel, out of the Marine Corps, was the head of military intelligence in the Marine Corps at one point. But at the time of the Osama bin Laden takedown, when Nicholas Schmeidel is happily working for a Google CIA think tank, just so happens that Nicholas Schmeidel's father, General four-star General Schmeidel, is the head of the Cyber Warfare Division at the NSA.
Oh, God.
So the fish stinks from the head down on this one for me, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. These are just the facts that I uncovered.
Well, that's it.
So
you don't have to be I don't like the term conspiracy theorist. I usually just say conspiracy realist. Because, you know, this stuff, it's not just people with tinfoil hats. There's a lot to it. There's a reason. Yeah.
Exactly. So I subsequently, I'm very resourceful. I've got Nicholas Schmeidel's cell phone number, his email address. I've got nice little pictures of his family and his new baby and everything. And I'm communicating with the guy. And obviously, he doesn't like the kinds of things I'm insinuating, and he blocks me. He hasn't gotten rid of his cell phone yet. He's still got the same cell phone number. I left him a message the other day.
Well, now, yeah, you don't want to get in trouble for stalking at that point.
Well, I don't call him, but maybe every 6 months or so.
Oh, okay. So that, all
just
right.
Just to let him know I'm still alive and thinking about him.
Oh, that's sweet. Exactly. He's still in your thoughts.
In my thoughts. And if you ever want to come clean about your surreptitious writing skills, I'd love to talk to you if you'd ever like to be honest about the things you think you know.
Yeah. If you ever want to come clean,
but I don't have the kind of access that Glenn Greenwald has, but you know, you'd be better off going with Glenn.
Didn't Glenn Knotts come into the country recently because he was afraid?
He's being a little leery about coming back to the United States after his interlude with Edward Snowden. And I think he may still be out of the country based upon the last dialogue that I heard him talking about.
Well, Brian, I thought he was supposed to have been here this past weekend.
He did come back. Oh, maybe he did.
Did he come back? No, did he? No, I thought he was supposed to come for the socialist convention, and then
he didn't come back for that.
Well, I heard he was going to do an address. You know, they would see it, but he would still be out of country.
I did not hear that, but I did see that he came back for the actual social conference, and I did see him speak. He was awesome. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then he did come back. Wow. Okay,
no, he came back via Skype. He did it on Skype. I'm sorry. He did it on Skype.
That's what I thought was going to, yeah, because, yeah, he doesn't need to be coming in this country right now, probably.
As a reporter, I don't think he broke any laws, but as he releases the documents that were stolen, I think that puts him in a different class of reporting. I'm not against what he's doing, but at the same time, I know what he's doing is illegal. And he's taking a chance. So, you know, it's a hell of a career movement. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of a story. On June 8th, I was lucky enough to go to the USS Liberty memorial at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier with many of the survivors.
Oh, my God.
And Press TV was kind enough to send out a film crew and film the event and interview some of the survivors. And one of the survivors' sons, and I won't mention who, because the son is in the Navy and in the Office of Naval Intelligence. I had asked him to do an interview, and he said, "Oh no, I can't." He said, "If I do that, he said, I'll be jeopardizing my security clearance." And and then he proceeded to take off his name tag. So.
Oh.
So. So I, you know, so I, and he's, you know, he's a, he's, I have to, you know, I have to, out of respect for his father, because his father was, you know, a spoken
survivor.
Out.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
No, you said a survivor?
Yeah, he's a survivor. He was heavily, he was basically heavily honored with many awards, but all of them were, because they were basically, here's your award, now shut up and don't talk about this.
Exactly.
So,
and I feel so bad when, you know, those men still gather every year. And
they
just want Congress to admit what happened or look into it or something.
Well, they're betrayed. These gentlemen have been incredibly betrayed by Lyndon Johnson's administration. And if you really know the story behind that, you get the backstory from, you know, the kinds of assholes that were advising Johnson, and the kind of asshole Johnson was.
He himself was.
You know,
Attorney still has a radio show every Sunday.
He's invited me to be on that in September.
Oh, yeah, he's really something. I wanted to tell you, Krell in chat just said that Snowden was just offered asylum by Venezuela. So.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Yay.
I got a lot of respect for Hugo Chavez. Fortunately, the South Americans woke up to the North American covert operations down there in the 60s and the 70s. It's just, thank God that they were able to survive that. And the Americans have hopefully lost their foothold in the corrupt and surreptitious, scandalous activities that they've been conducting there for, you know, decades.
I would hope
prior. I hope so. I mean, because I really believe that this is one thing I don't have information on, but it seems quite suspicious that a lot of the leaders of those nations, you know, came down with, like, horrific cancer at the same time.
I'm talking with somebody about that today. Yeah.
I just find that, you know, maybe it's coincidental, but it certainly doesn't seem right. And I put my hat out to guys like Oliver Stone and, you know, Mickey Huff. And I mentioned a few of these kind of guys who, you know, really kind of work outside. Mickey Huff with Project Centered. And he does a great job at, you know, cutting through the what I would call the media diversions or deceptions. And, you know, Oliver Stone's movie, if you haven't seen it, is South of the Border.
No, I haven't.
It's quite good. What he did is he put together a documentary that basically went through the last decade or so of South American politics. And how it evolved and emerged out of the kind of American corruption and influence that was going on. And one of the things I found quite interesting that I'd never heard of, you know, we should have all known, but were never taught, was Brazil, when he was interviewing the president of Brazil, the president said, "Well, we've paid off the IMF, and we have one more payment to make to the Paris Club." And I was like, "Well, what the hell is the Paris Club?"
Right.
So, I paused it and I went and looked it up while I was watching the program, and I was like, "Oh, son of a bitch, never heard of these guys." And it's a group of very prominent bankers that meet every month in Paris and control investments in countries that are in the third world, developing nations. and they're the ones that basically, you know, put countries in debt slavery. And so it was quite interesting, you know, to see, you know, because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to go and look at how the GDPs from countries are kind of, you know, aligned against these countries. You know, no matter how hard they work, you know, for every dollar they make, we make, they make 10 cents, you know, so, and it's not about how hard you work, it's about, you know, how we control the finances that flow in and out of your country.
That's very sad.
And it's in BRICS, you know, if you look at the Brazilian, Russian, Indian, China, and now South Africa, the BRICS alliance, what people don't realize is that BRICS actually is for every dollar that we make, they can only make 50 cents in one of those countries. So their GDP per capita is half of our GDP because they're outside the control of the NATO aligned states. And all the NATO aligned states and allies are all one for one on GDP, dollar for dollar. So if I'm earning a dollar, you're earning a dollar in your economy. And the only countries that exceed that are actually Norway, Switzerland, and Qatar. And they're actually double. So they're earning $2 for every dollar that we earn in the NATO states. And there's a good reason for that. What people don't realize is that you have to look at history of those nations. And those nations have gotten special treatment from the major allies that run the world right now, which are France, UK, and US. These are, you know, I call it the fuck us alliance, F-U-K-U-S. And these three countries basically owe back to Switzerland and to Norway. Most people aren't aware that Norway, if you've ever taken a cruise, the captain of the ship's probably Norwegian. And the reason for that is the Jebsen family. It's J-E-B-S-E-N. And the Jebsen group is one of the most powerful shipping groups in the world because even 300 years ago, they were shipping 70,000 tons a year of heroin into China for the British. So it's these little pieces of history that people need to understand that basically drive today's alliances. And it's not something that's, you won't find any of this in the Encyclopedia Britannica.
No, or the local history book down at the corner school. I wanted to ask you about whistleblowing. Though, do you see more people doing this now that these have been so highly publicized, Scott? Or do you think that because of the treatment of these men that people are going to back off?
Well, you got to have access. You know, there's a lot of people who whistleblow. You know, William Binney's a great example. He said the exact same things that Snowden said, but, you know, it was like a lone man yelling in a desert. You know, he never got any publicity. So in 2005, William Binney came out and talked about how, you know, the government was being so operating so illegally by basically conducting surveillance against innocent Americans. And, you know, they went into his house. He was taking a shower and came in guns a-blazing, you know, pulling back the shower curtain. And all he really did was lose his job because, you know, he was trying to do it the right way and basically get in front of Congress and testify to the government, like, hey, you know, we can't be doing this. But because he didn't have access to a Glenn Greenwald, which I think is great what Glenn's doing, but there's not a whole lot of guys out there that are willing to, you know, talk so courageously and so, I'd say, in a dissident manner that get any sort of access to, you know, televisions or newspapers or magazines. You know, there's a very tight group of people that control, you know, the publications, and you know, truly the publications drive the television, because televisions are just repeating what the actual, you know, AP, UPI, Reuters, BBC, Agence Presse France, you know, you name it. Those are the folks that have been running the show since 1600s, 1700s. You know, the same people are involved. I mean, there's, you know, people come in and there's acquisitions, and there, you know, when somebody gets a good large voice, you know, organizations are acquired. And, you know, look at the kind of acquisitions that have occurred in our lifetime, gobbling up, even recently with Al Jazeera gobbling up Current TV. You know, you've got Qatar, which, by the way, is being treated quite specially by the global finance guys. And they've just bought an American television station that was partly partnered, owned by Al Gore. And they paid $500 million, which was about $12.50 per subscriber. There's about 40 million subscribers to the Current TV network. And they paid $500 million for this particular network, which, you know, that network would have sold, if it was any other network, for probably close to maybe $200 million, $250 million. So they paid double what it was worth.
Wow.
And, you know, so these are the kind of things, you know, you've got, obviously, Al Jazeera is a mouthpiece for the status quo media. And now they've bought Current, which was, you know, probably one of the more up-and-coming American networks that had guys like Cenk Uygur that, you know, was, you know, sort of trying to break the glass ceiling, you know, and of media, I would say, control or influence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's narrow. You can narrow it down to, you know, less than, you know, a dozen companies. And the average person couldn't even tell you who, you know, Interactive Corp is or Condé Nast. You mentioned Condé Nast, and they're going to think of the travel group of Condé Nast.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that Condé Nast owns, you know, The New Yorker and Vanity Fair and some other, you know, incredibly popular magazines. And it goes back, and those relationships at Condé Nast go all the way back to, early publications in France in the 1600s and 1700s.
Families and companies that were going hundreds of years ago are still alive.
They're wildly successful. I mean, McGraw-Hill is a great example in this country. You know, most people think that they're just a publisher, right? But every book that you and I had and our parents had and even our grandparents since the early 1900s, McGraw-Hill's been printing the majority of our school books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, McGraw-Hill owns the Standards and Poor's, the S&P 500. You know, McGraw-Hill rates our state's finances, rates our national finances, you know, rates international finances. So, you know, and they're making our books? I'm not sure. There's a little bit of smoke there. You know, there might be some fire.
Well, that might be one of the reasons why the history we studied was a pack of lies.
It has been, you know, and when you've got people like Snowden and William Binney and I think people are giving Julian Assange a little too much credit. It was great that he created a place where people could potentially share information, but it's also, you have to be suspicious that it can also be used as a way to mislead us as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the source, it's better to know where the source originated and then have some origination on it. But having the secrecy on the source sometimes, you know, who knows how that can be manipulated. So I have to consider the source with Julian Assange.
That's what several people are saying now. And, yeah, well, anytime somebody does something anonymously, their credibility is just sort of, if not lost, at least compromised.
Well, I wouldn't say it's compromised, but it's potentially It could be, some sort of psychological operation. I mean, I'm not an anti-Alex Jones guy, and people get on me every once in a while when I post things from David Duke. But, as far as I'm concerned, a broken clock is right twice a day, and I don't care where I find stuff that I find to be legitimate.
That's what I tell people. Yes, I'll take it from wherever. Yeah, okay.
But even Alex Jones, I mean, sometimes he's just a little overzealous for me, and I think about it, and I go, okay, well, Stalin said, if you want to manage dissent, control it. And so, some of these guys, and I'm not saying Alex is one of them, but some of these guys, might be out there creating this kind of noise that basically like bug lights. They want to attract moths to the flame and figure out, who the dissidents are and get them on a list and say, okay, and makes their job easier.
Exactly. Well, that was what recently I saw a couple things about David Kokesh, and they were saying that about him. That
are you thinking Adam Kokesh?
I mean Adam. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Things were just a little bit too neat or something. But gotta check that out some more.
I'm not sure about him. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was like gung ho for him at one point too, but then it's like, well, okay, now I've got to.
Well, I've hung around him. I've actually met him a few times, and then I've also talked to a bunch of other people. He never really speaks out against Israel. And the other thing that's a little suspicious about him that I don't really care for is he's kind of immature a lot. He does a lot of things that just kind of make me say, well, I'm pretty far off the reservation. When somebody gives me that feeling, they know that guy's gone too far. So
And sometimes
he does some very immature things sometimes, and I think, okay, that's I can't get too close to a guy like that because not that I'm trying to protect my reputation, but it's not productive.
Well, it's not productive, and it seems sometimes it's more about the ego than the cause.
Perhaps I mean he might be having fun. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
I don't know, but I wanted to ask any advice for people who need, like we all do, to really find out, where would you send people to start doing their research?
I'll tell you, as an intelligence guy and things that I've been able to uncover using the internet and Facebook, get online, find people that you, find any kind of value in what they've written, what they've, what they've done interviews on. Track them down, read their books. That's the best thing because, there's even some of the professors out there. I was lucky enough to have some incredible, psychiatrists that were, teaching at universities or have been professionals their entire lives. And, I've gone into detail on Edward Bernays and some of the work that he did. And most people never heard of him. But they've all heard of his uncle. His uncle is Sigmund Freud. But without the nephew, Sigmund Freud would have never been a household name. And a lot of the psychiatrists went, geez, it's funny. I've been teaching psychiatry or I've been practicing my entire life, and I never knew that his nephew was the one that made him so popular in America. And they confirmed after they do their own research. It's amazing. As a psychiatrist, I was never taught that. So it's a fact.
Well, we can't just take somebody else's word for something. We shouldn't. We really need to check it out ourselves. But Scott, our time is up.
Well, we've never had the opportunity to do it on our own until now. So and that's the beauty is what we've actually got to do now these days.
We do. So I want to thank you so much, and I hope you'll come on again.
I'd love to.
All right. Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend in beautiful Florida.
You too.
And enjoy those fireworks, man.
They're going off in a minute. I got my son looking at me. He's getting angry.
okay then. Time.
All right. Thank you so much.
Florida. Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Using ancient techniques taught by our ancestors, we express the spirit of tradition from cultures all across the planet. We blend by hand and we create with light and intention for use, using fragrance and subtle essences to awaken your sensuality, both physical and subtle, all for the mystical exploration of you. DaughtersofIsis.com. Come find us.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Hello again, and I'm Ruthanna Marte Fio, back with David Williams. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
I am great. Have you been enjoying the fireworks?
Yeah, I still have all of my digits and all that, so that's always good.
Oh, good, good. So we've got another year with you with your digits. This is wonderful.
Yeah, I experienced a little bit of burn on my thumb, but that was... I was lighting one of my son's sparklers, and lo and behold, that magnesium gets pretty hot.
I thought we talked about that the other day on Skype.
I know it. I know it.
Well, at least you still have also. Yeah. I wanted to say you can be found at www.rt7.com.
Roundtree7, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and any other sites you want to give out right now? You're part of the Commons Project Network.
Yeah, the Commons Project Network .com, and it's a collaboration of several people, Citizens Journal, Worldwide Hippies, and Pinko the Bear's got his stuff over there, Derek Johnson, Roundtree 7, and several others. So check us out. It's the commonsprojectnetwork.com. And it's sort of like a village square where everybody can put their stuff and let people see it, and it launches them over to their own websites or blogs or YouTube channels or whatever. So it's pretty neat.
It is neat, and it's just another way to get the word out, because everybody who's involved has something to say, and really I think that we're all trying to wake people up.
Exactly. Covered a lot of subjects. And again, like I said, it's not really a blog in itself. It's sort of like the office water cooler or the village square where everybody can just announce what they're doing. And from there, you go to that particular site.
Yes, you find somebody who's like, okay, that's what I want to find out more about. So I will go there. Tonight, we're talking about two different things, but you can make an analogy between anything, I think. But we're going to start out with energy harvesting. And that...
Yes, energy harvesting, it's sort of a new thing in a way, but it's been around for a long, long time. And what energy harvesting is producing energy from something that normally is there already. Normal energy production is, it takes oil or coal or whatever, and it produces energy from that, electricity. But this energy harvesting, it just takes something that's already there. Like you may have a little vibration generator in your shoe or something, and as you're walking, it generates electricity so it can run your cell phone. Or there's another thing, and this is a big initiative in Africa, is... they obviously didn't have a very established infrastructure for electricity and grid, so there's this big, it's called the African Development Foundation, and they're trying to produce all these localized electricity off-grid production. And one of the things I thought was pretty neat is they developed these soccer balls that, as you play them during the day, it generates electricity, and then at night... it has a little cap, it unplugs, and you can plug it in, and it runs their cell phones or runs their lights or whatever, so they can read at night.
Yes, wonderful. Soccer balls.
Yeah.
Because I saw about bicycles in Africa.
Bicycles. And you know, that's a really important thing for, you know, third world is that, you know, they just don't have the capability of having a grid power. So all these little ideas that can produce electricity, they can be life-saving, you know. It's
really
an amazing thing. And you know, there are several ways that they can do it. You know, they have, like, piezo, where it takes and captures movement. You know, I think it was in France, they had a big marathon, and at the end of the marathon, they had all these big tiles that they ran across, and the crowd, as they ran across these tiles would produce electricity, and they generated quite a lot of electricity, enough to, I forget how much it was, but it was like, you know, 10 kilowatts or something, some huge amount. And there's other ways. I mean, they have thermal, where if you have you know, something that goes from cold to hot or hot to cold, they have something called a Peltier junction that generates electricity from this thermal shift, you know. And then, of course, you got solar, which is the big thing that, you know, in a way, it's generating electricity from something that's free, the sun. And, you know, in my own opinion, I think that that should be the end-all point where we need to go to, because, I mean, let's face it, when the sun dies, we're pretty much gone anyway, so...
Or not cooked, yeah, we're frozen out. So, yeah, the sun is it, and it is free. And solar panels now are actually much more reasonable than they were a few years ago. Also,
they are very reasonable. The efficiencies of them are getting up there, and some of the people are doing it more like the do-it-yourself type thing, where they, you know, a solar panel is some of it is like the aluminum frame that makes the panel, you know, it's mounting. But some people take just a little sort of chips they have, and they make their own panels. And so they're saving quite a lot of money that way. And, you know, it's sort of getting into where the do-it-yourselfers are really driving the market pretty good. But, I mean, there's definitely a lot of corporations that are more accepting of it. And, you know, if you check it out on the Internet, there are several sites that will allow you to set up your own. They have really two different ways of going with that. They can have a solar cell or solar panels that you drive your own home and, you know, just be off-grid where you just run your own house. But then they have also others that if you get enough solar panels, you can generate enough excess energy, you can sell it back to the grid. And it gets a little more complicated.
Yeah, but I've heard of that. It's like, wow, that would be really good. And also, you don't have to, like, you'll see the pictures or you see in person the solar panels on the rooftop, and, you know, they seem pretty stationary and all, but there's actually smaller ones that people in apartments, now this isn't going to heat or cool your whole apartment, but you can, you know, run some utensils off of it. You can just stick it outside your window.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes if you just want to run something at that moment, you know, you don't have to invest too much in batteries and all that stuff, you know, because that's where you're storing the energy. If you just want to have the energy right then, and you just put a 40 to 100 watt panel out there, and there's a lot of things that you can run just off of the sun just at that moment, and not have to worry about the expensive battery storage. So
exactly.
Yes, you're right.
Coffee grinders come to mind.
Coffee grinders, yeah.
I mean, I'm always like, okay, where can I grind the
coffee? But this energy harvesting, it's really sort of a fascinating subject. It's really sort of coming in its own, because there's other things that they're using for, like wireless sensors. That, you know, they can put wireless sensors in, say, bridges or something like that, and it never has to have a battery. It just uses the vibration of cars that go over the bridge. And then, like, once a day, it wirelessly reports back, you know, stresses and strains or whatever of the day. And, it, you know, it can run for an extremely long time, just embedded in the concrete. They have now, I've seen where it's like a Wi-Fi switch for a light switch that, you know, the very action of flipping the switch up and down is enough to generate enough energy to wirelessly transmit to print on a light bulb. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, there's all sorts of different things that's, you know, sort of really unlimited the amount of things you can do. I'm actually doing a project right now that uses a wireless harvesting. It basically uses water movement, and it generates enough energy. It has this one particular circuitry that, you know, you think of it like little puffs of air. Every time gets movement, little puffs of air goes into a balloon, and then eventually when the balloon gets so big, it has enough pressure in it that allows it to go out there and transmit to wherever place that you want it to transmit its information to. So, you know, there's just a lot of a new circuitry that allows all this stuff to happen. And it's really sort of a new field that's...
Does it take a lot of water for this project?
Excuse me?
Is it taking a lot of water for this project?
No, this would be like water that's normally there. Say it's like an irrigation channel or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And you had
okay.
Water going down the irrigation channel, but eventually you wanted to say, okay, well, how much water came down this irrigation channel? And instead of having something out there with batteries where you got to run power out to it, you just have this little device that at the end of the whole thing, it said, oh, I got enough energy now, I can wirelessly send out how much irrigation water got sent out to this crop field, or I'm just giving this as an example. But
that's interesting. How did you get interested in this, David?
Well, I'm in the industrial measurement field. I'm an electrical engineer by trade, and you know, I got into it because I do a lot of stuff with water measurement and. And some of the places that we do this water measurement, you know, there's not going to be any kind of power there. You know, we're doing some stuff down in Central America and also doing some stuff in the Middle East and China, all sorts of places. And, you know, it's amazing the remote places that you can do some of this stuff and then sort of wirelessly get it out far enough that you can get the information to a central location. So, anyway, that's how I got into it.
And so you're running with it.
Yeah,
I saw where it can be used they can attach something or other, like with the military. Like the military is going in pretty big for this. Or the companies are targeting the military, companies who deal in this. Because, like sniper rifles, different things like that. I don't understand quite if that means that they wouldn't have to use the batteries that they use now.
Well, yeah, a lot of the, I guess it's this new military is everything is connected. You know, they have these military networks where everything is connected, and they're converging with this information plans. And of course, that requires a lot of battery packs and energy and all that stuff. But you know, I would be surprised if they could get too much energy harvesting out of that, because some of that stuff they do, it requires a lot of power. You know, some of that imaging and stuff like that. But I'm sure they're involved in it some way. You know, if there's anything as far as electronics or something, the military has usually got something going on.
Right. Well, you had mentioned the shoes, and I did read that wasn't at least at the time that they weren't recommending that. It seemed like it's in the heel of the shoes, and people said it felt like they were walking on sand.
Oh yeah, it might be. Well, there's you know, all sorts of products. Like one I mentioned is a little Piezo pad. It's called a MIDI Vulture pad, and you know, it sells, I think, like $80 or something like that. But it, you know, it's just you could tap on it and you generate electricity, and eventually it would generate enough to run your cell phone for 10 minutes
So that would be actually well worth it when you're out in the wilds of somewhere, as long as there's some kind of satellite
And I forget the name of the tablet, but there was a a crowdfunded tablet that just came out of Android that actually harvested energy. It had a solar panel on the back of it, and but it also harvested by movement, and it was pretty cool. It was a little tablet, and it had Wi-Fi, and it was meant to be out in the woods for like campers and stuff like that, you know. But it was very rugged, and it had a built-in two-way radio that if another person had a tablet. It also had GPS maps and stuff built into it, and I can't remember what the name of the tablet was, but it was a crowdfunded tablet, and it used a lot of energy harvesting for its power.
Yeah, well, and so then like typing would produce energy on that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much anything that you can think of as far as movement or any kind of flow or temperature differential or sound or even radio waves. There's energy harvesting things that will pull radio waves out of the air, and eventually it generates enough. It builds up slowly but surely, and it eventually gets to the point that it has enough to do its function and then go back to sleep again until the next time. So it runs completely without any kind of power or batteries or anything like that. And you know, one thing that comes to mind is I think there's a medical device that they implant. There's also other medical devices they're looking at that you would swallow, and it energy harvests and transmits biological information out as it's going through your bloodstream. You know, very small MEMS type device.
Yeah, I'm sure that something like that is very useful medically. But there's something about any kind of swallows or implants or things.
Oh,
that
I agree. Yes.
It's like, I don't like that.
Yeah, or anything that's transmitting. Well, you know, a lot of the RFID tags that you have in your store.
Yeah.
You know, most of them are passive. You know, the little sort of strange-looking, swirly aluminum foil-looking things. You know,
right.
As you're walking out of the box stores, it sets off the alarm.
Yeah.
But some of them are a little more active. And how that works is they transmit, you know, these little, one thing I think comes to mind is a credit card, some of those smart cards.
Mm.
Well, when you get it close to the card reader, it transmits energy out, and the credit card picks up the energy and retransmits back its info back to the reader. But, you know, it can get a little big brother-y sounding, you know, with all these RFID tags and all that stuff. And
I tend to
agree that, it can be that, you know, there has to be a little bit of ethics
that
involved with some of this stuff.
That card doesn't have to be sending any of its information anywhere, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, walking out of a store, that's not. Well, and that's probably one of the reasons, even though they said, I mean, they gave some others, but when people started buying those metal containers.
Uh-huh. Oh, the little wallets?
to put the cards.
Exactly. Yeah, I actually, you know, it wouldn't take very much research to make a little credit card reader that I could walk around the airport and scan people's credit cards, you know. If I was go over to the dark side, I suppose.
Yeah, okay, well, stay on the light side. I think that's a better thing.
Yeah, I'm there.
I know you're here. So,
yeah.
Well, then, you know, going from like what you're doing and all these people who are doing the energy harvesting and using it for the good, we'll concentrate on the good. Then we get into people who are just doing the exact opposite, the zombie.
Yeah, and that is a good tie-in because technology, you know, it's like a double-edged sword. You know, the more you accept it and the more you expect it to serve you, sort of the more that you serve it in a way. You know, I mean, it's been said that cell phones are like wireless bugs that you can happen to make a phone call with. And in a way, it's true. You know, and other things that people are just sort of accepting, and they're accepting it, and they're giving up things that, you know, in the back of their mind, they know they're giving them up, you know, like privacy and stuff like that.
Oh.
But they seem to be sort of accepting of that. It's like, look, as long as I can get the latest gadget or the latest tablet or whatever, I'm willing to do that almost unconditionally. You know, and let the other things that go along with it, you know, it just it does become sort of a zombie mindset that people are willing to accept all these things without even giving some sort of second thought to what they're accepting. I don't know if that is technically the term of a zombie, you know, and it doesn't have anything to do with brains or anything, but
but
more, maybe more like lemmings, you know, we're all sort of jumping off the cliff. So if lemmings are zombies, I guess, but you know what I'm saying is people are so accepting of new technology, and as long as it's a cool gadget,
yes,
they automatically gravitate towards it and voluntarily make it part of their lives without realizing the repercussions of what they're doing. You know, it eventually is going to become to a point where technology has all these slaves, and we're the slaves to the technology. The technology is not serving us. We're serving technology.
I had a mini conversation with a friend a few days ago about that, because he tries to get all the latest, and you know, I was talking about, I mean, between just the GPS of the car, but the smartphone and this and that and all this, there's no part of his life where he's not where he has real privacy.
No.
He said, "Well, yeah, I know they track me," and I'm going like, "Yeah, so why do you, you know?" But he wants these things, and he's
exactly. Yeah, they're willing to accept that loss for the coolness of the gadget. And in a way, that is sort of a zombie mentality. I mean,
I think so. It's,
I don't understand it at all. For instance, I'll give another example. The new Xbox with the Kinect, not the one that's been out for a while, but the new one. It has the capability of turning on the Kinect part, which has a camera and a microphone remotely. In other words, you can't make sure that the Kinect is turned off. It doesn't have an on-off switch. The Xbox keeps it on, or can turn it on, or it can be networked to turn on. So in other words, it becomes a portal to your household. And people are accepting this because they want the ability to walk into the room and say, "I want to play this game," or "Xbox turn on," or "Xbox get me Netflix," or whatever. And they're accepting the gadgetry, but they're giving up the privacy and all these other little things, you know.
Yeah,
not really little things, but
well,
and in a way that is a zombie culture,
right? Because it's almost robotic. It's getting there. It's we're such a consumerized society.
We are, you know, probably the number one consumerized society in the world. You know, it's sort of funny. I wrote a story one time about this guy that he had went into a coma and he woke up like 10 years later. I think the name of the story was called The Me Network. And what it was the guy that went into a coma, he was a spy. And he had been found out of poison, but instead of killing him, it put him in a coma. And then 10 years later, he woke up, and he was in this hospital room. And as you go further and further along in the story, the doctors and the nurses and all this stuff, they have this little box that they're always constantly watching. And what it is called the Me Network. And the Me Network allows a person to upload all the things that they did during the day. And people were doing this voluntarily, and you know, and you would watch a friend's day, what they did that, you know, and it was like the complete loss of privacy for the sake of narcissism.
Ooh, it takes a certain mind to write a story like that, David.
I don't know if that's a compliment or what. Hey.
Well, I love your mind. I don't know about that story, though.
you don't think it could happen? I mean, isn't it, in a way, happening right now on Facebook?
It's happening.
Yeah. But, you know, if the technology was there that allowed you to record all your feelings and all your visual, you know, everything that you saw, everything that you felt during the day, and upload it so other people could experience it. Do you not think that people would do that?
Oh, sure. Well, and people are so, I don't know, numbed down. You know, they will pay money to subscribe and watch some woman in still dressed, but in scantily dressed, ironing, for God's sake.
Yeah. Or look at a lot of the reality shows where they're, you know, it's just people, I guess they call them Big Brother shows or whatever. Or it's people that are just living, but other people are watching these people living. You know, I mean, they're experiencing someone else's life.
Right.
I guess it's to replace their own or vicariously, you know, by some sort of thrill, see what kind of poor condition or you know.
Well, that's it. I think it brings to some of them, you know, that feeling of, well, thank God, my life isn't that bad.
For some reason, that Honey Boo Boo or whatever the character was that comes to mind, and you know, people are watching out like it's a car wreck, but they're all saying, oh, for the grace of God, that could be me or something, you know, and maybe it allows them to elevate themselves psychologically somehow.
Because their own self-esteem is so low then?
Yeah, exactly. Would that be the reason you would watch that? I mean, it's obviously not for any kind of information some sort of intelligence or anything. It's,
I don't know. I saw about 2 minutes. I thought this was a joke. I was at a friend's house and, you know, they were flipping through. And I thought this was a joke because I didn't know who the hell Honey Boo Boo is. And then, you know, they told me and I'm like, what? This is child abuse. And they're getting paid for it kind of thing, you know?
I got out. And they're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
No, it is child abuse.
Your child? Okay, well, yes. Okay. It's all kinds of abuses. But
isn't that part of the human psychology, though? I mean, isn't it part of human psychology that we have to be around others in an inner, you know, act, even if that means, you know, being sort of a clown? I mean, you see some of these child beauty shows and stuff, you know, you think, well, that can't be normal. So, you know, they're so starved for public attention, they'll take it any way they can. You know, it's a sad thing, but
that's at 15 minutes of fame. That who talked about that years and years? Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol. 15 minutes of fame.
15 minutes of fame, and boy, people want theirs. That vicarious living. And whenever somebody says that, it always makes me think. Years ago, I heard an Amway person talking. You know, he was one that had the diamond rings and all this, and he was talking about, you know, people could either be going on cruises, you know, making money from Amway, or staying home and watching reruns of The Love Boat. And I thought, okay, you can either do it or watch it. You know,
which is better.
You can actually live life or watch somebody else living life. Sad.
It is very sad.
She doesn't own a cell phone, and she communicates when she wants to with her laptop or home phone, and she doesn't own a game box. So, but she knows she can be monitored when she's online, and that's true. I don't have a smartphone.
I got like a jitterbug type phone, you know, with a big button so I can see them and all that, you know.
Okay. I've got the home phone. I've got the cell, but the cell, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't take, I mean, you know, it can text, which I rarely do. It doesn't take pictures. It doesn't ring this and ring that, and I can't go online from it. And I'm fine with that. I don't like necessarily for people to know where I am, but as far as what I stand for or whatever, I mean, it's all over Facebook, so, and I know that's looked at, so, you know, at this point I'm not going to try to get all private about that, but as far as where I am, that kind of thing, and who I'm with, what I'm doing, that's my own business. And I don't want to walk
in. Yeah, I see what you're saying. No? Yeah, you know, I think we all sort of, I mean, I've sort of accepted Facebook as, you know, it's like the public forum where, you know, it's like you're talking in a line of a movie theater. Everything you say can be heard by everybody, but it can also be used for as an advantage because you can get your ideas out there.
Right.
And you know, have a collective of like-minded people that think the same thing, and you can build up groups and coalitions and stuff like that. So it can be a useful tool.
It's a wonderful tool.
You have to realize that it's certainly has its limitations, you know.
Yeah. And some people don't use it wisely at all, but I think we're going back sort of that zombie thing too, because you'll look up somebody who wants to be your friend, and they've just, well, some people put no information, but others have everything. It's just...
I've seen those. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's like...
I'll be going on vacation on Saturday of next week, and you know, and I'll be taking pictures and all this stuff, and it's like, you know, come on, come over and rob me.
Yeah. I mean, I do that, but I also make sure that, I mean, when I'm going to be gone, because I'm going to be offline, so I said I'm going and I'm pushing for the place I'm going anyway. But, you know, I have somebody who comes in, hangs out, and takes care of my felines and everything. So, plus, I don't put my address on Facebook or my phone number.
Which,
to me, that's totally crazy. I had to tell my cousin just a while back on Facebook and just had her address or phone number, everything, and I'm yelling, you know, get that off of there, you know, it doesn't need to be.
You know, that I just thought of something. You know, we went to the town fireworks display at the lake yesterday, and they had these things, they called them lanterns, and they would light them up, and it reminded me of those Japanese lanterns where they had the flame in them, and they would slowly rise up in the air.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen them. It was pretty cool, and I thought, you know, it would be really cool if you could somehow make a, like a camera that would just shine down and, like, every once in a while, maybe once a month, and using the energy harvesting, once a month it would just send out a picture of where it was, you know.
Oh,
maybe if it got up high enough, you know, in a jet stream or something, and, like, slowly dip down every once in a while and then go back up again, and, you know, wouldn't it be cool if you, like, 1 month it had a picture of Japan, and the next month it was like the Swiss Alps. And
that'd be,
you know,
wonderful. Okay, David, get to work on that.
Okay, but, my spare time.
Because right in your spare time, but that would be wonderful because it's using the wind power, the jet current.
Yeah, exactly. You would harvest enough energy so that once a week or whatever, you know, you'd have to look at how much energy you get, and then you wandered around, and then maybe it indicated where it was near a Wi-Fi thing or cell tower, and then it would just blurp out a picture, you know, and then the picture would be on a website or something and say, hey, look, here's a farmhouse in Iowa, and, you know.
Well, now that's it. It would have to have lat and longitude on it something.
Well, yeah, you could do it with a cell phone. The cell phone has the GPS coordinates, so you could do it where you could actually put it on Google Maps.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing I do is there's, you know, Google Maps where it has all the, I don't know if you got into Google Maps that much, but you can see infrastructure and the streets and all that stuff. Well, there's something in it of a more professional thing. It's called Esri, and it's a mapping platform. But, you know, it allows you to put layers of stuff like, okay, here's a layer and you have all the fire hydrants, and here's a layer that has all the stoplights, and here's a layer that has all the whatever, and it allows you to put real-time stuff in there too. So, you know, you could have like the GPS coordinates, and it would pop up and say, here's a cornfield in Iowa, and the next day here's a two cows in Kansas.
now that would be fun and interesting and harmless.
It would, yeah. That's a prime example of energy harvesting. You know, you don't have power, you don't have batteries, but, you know, I'm really fascinated with energy harvesting for nations that just don't have power, you know, Africa and
besides soccer balls and bicycling in Africa, What do you know of something else that they're using right now? Or
well, they have other things where they have like hand cranked generators. They have, of course, the little wind turbines. You know, some of them are vertical. They don't have like the propellers. It looks like an egg beater or something. You know,
oh.
And they have those. And then, you know, another thing that I was sort of fascinated with, it doesn't have to do with energy harvesting, but it was a really cool idea. And I'd actually thought of something like it, but I got to reading about it, and it's called a life straw. And what it is, it's like the straw that allows a person to go up to, you know, the water condition in Africa is just terrible, but they can go up to a contaminated pond or whatever, and they can suck up the water through this life straw, and it filters it out enough that they can get, you know, not have to worry about cholera and all the other diseases and stuff. It's called life straw, and it's just amazing thing that, you know, it sort of goes along with the energy harvesting. You could have a life straw, you could have energy harvesting, and, you know, these little items like this are technology at its best. It can bring things that can make and enrich someone's life so much more, you know, in these third world countries. And you know, it's almost our duty to present that technology to them, you know,
our duty. I mean, it's much better than moving a McDonald's in, for God's sake.
You
know, that kind of thing.
Like that. That does nothing for the country.
Yeah, absolutely. But, well, that's it, because I think that people in America, though, because we've been surrounded by things, and we're taught to believe that things make us happy. And if you watch TV, you see the commercials. I mean, you even get the commercials on YouTube now.
Or Facebook. I'm starting to get stuff on Facebook now. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's how our culture is driven. To develop that urge for something that we have to have. You know, there was a big thing on, I think it was Facebook, about someone that just got killed waiting on some tennis shoes, some sneakers, some new basketball sneakers or something. There was a shootout in the line for people trying to, they've been waiting there for like a day to buy these stupid sneakers for $150. And you know, that's the psychology of want, you know, that's, you know, you've been sort of hypnotized in a way, you know, propaganda has been hypnotized, that you've gotten to the point where your need is so great to buy this product that you haven't even seen before. And, you know, 6 months from now, you may not have you may have it in your closet wondering why you bought it.
Right.
But at that moment, the need is just so great. It's because marketing is so fine-tuned to our mind.
Well,
you know,
yeah, I fight with Brian Stetton about that. You know, he and I host a show together once a week called Progress Toward Democracy. And he and I offline, we argue, because I say, you know, people do have brains, and they don't have to just succumb to all this advertising and propaganda. And he just talks about how they're so dummy down or numb down or whatever, he doesn't blame them, because I want people to take some responsibility for their stupidity. And he thinks that we shouldn't blame them because of the way society has done. And they've got to this numb/dumb state. What do you think?
Well,
about
in a way, he has a good point, because, you know, I've read some studies, like there was this one study where I think it was like a set up as a job interview, or you had to do something. But anyway, they found that someone that had warm hands, that touched these warm hands, were 90% more likely to make a positive decision towards something else. So if you could go in there and touch someone with your hand after holding a cup of coffee and your hands are warm, it's psychologically, it affected your decisions. And you're like hardwired for that. You know, it's like, even as an infant, you've always sought warmth as safety and a positive thing. So the fact of having someone touch you with warm hands, and it was an amazing study. They were able to shift a decision, which normally would be 50-50, to 90% And you think about all these other things, you know, the power of color, the power of sight, the power of all this other thing. In a way, the zombies don't really have control of who they're going for or who they're choosing. Things are manipulated in such a sophisticated way nowadays. I mean, you still have a brain, of course, to choose something.
Yeah.
But you cannot deny the incredible influence and sophistication of marketing and advertising.
Oh, Madison Avenue. Wow. I mean, I you know how you can admire something you don't like? I have admired them for years. I think they did a fantastic job. You're talking colors. Yeah, that's why, supposedly, having not been there, but I hear jails and prisons have certain low-key, pastel-ish, maybe sandy colors. They don't have anything bright to get people all stimulated. Colors. You see one of our politicians, and you can count on him having a red tie on.
The power tie, yes. It's funny, I just saw a picture of the, I think it was the G8 or something, and they had them out there, I forget where they had it, in Ireland or someplace, but anyway, they had them all taking pictures of it, and they all wearing the same color suit and same tie. It's like, okay, who coordinated this? You know, but it's the way it is, you know, it's like they've...
Not clones, yeah. So you're saying that I shouldn't be too hard on Brian when he says that people
People, of course, can still make decisions, but don't underestimate the power of things that you subconsciously don't realize are influencing your decisions.
But then
there's a lot of powerful forces there. Why
do some of us, I mean, not that some things won't influence us, but why are we not out there trying to have all of these things and everything? Why isn't that hasn't appealed to us to the point that we have to get crazy?
Oh, I don't know. I wish I could answer that. I mean, why do we buy bottled water when it's for free? It's a tap.
You live where I live, you don't want to drink it from the tap. I would love to be able to drink from the tap again.
You're right. There is a lot of places like that, but there's also a lot of places, I can't complain about the tap water here. I have a lot of sort of inside information on the water health of systems around here. It's pretty good, and it's probably just as good as the people that are bottling water that are pulling it right out of the same place you're getting it.
Yeah. I tell people, if you're going to do it, if you're going to buy it, buy spring water. In fact, one of the brines that I buy here because it's available, my cousin actually visited the place and she said, there is something to it. But if you get where it says drinking water or purified water, that's just from the tap.
Yeah, it is.
It is. Use your own tap.
I mean, what subconsciously or consciously is saying as you walk into the convenience store that, ooh, there's some bottled water there, and even though it's the same water that I could get right here at the faucet, I have this desire to spend $1.29 or whatever for this bottled water. Is it the convenience of packaging, or is it the colors that what exactly is influencing that decision? You know, bottled water is really bad for the country. You know,
the
environment.
Exactly.
The plastic bottles, it is practically around forever. Landfill, I forget what large percentage are plastic bottles in landfills.
Plastic bottles and disposable diapers.
Yeah, disposable diapers.
Now,
in all honesty, when it comes to disposable diapers and the regular cloth diapers, now, I have to plead that I use disposable diapers when my kids were... Because, I went the regular cloth diaper route, and, man...
Yeah. I don't have... I think I would have gone the disposable, too. And I wouldn't have been happy with myself, but I think I probably...
I know, See, what we need to do is make a machine that will generate electricity, but it uses disposable diapers as fuel. Ah. Hey, there we go.
There you go. Well, you know.
Or she'd have to have a big filter on the exhaust pipe, I'm sure.
Well, you know, EcoArcs and things like that use everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just reused and reused and reused. And I have some friends who have a, it's not a complete EcoArc, but it's pretty much, I mean, they, you know, they've got the solar panels, they've got the greenhouse attached and the gray water and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible.
It is possible. You know, I forget the name, but I think it was Guy that you had on your show.
And
he had, yeah, exactly. And that guy was very knowledgeable. And you know, he was really sharp about all the information he was giving on the interview. Very good show.
Well, he's living in, actually, I think they live in New Mexico, just across from Arizona. I think Phoenix is a couple hours away. And they and another couple have some land there. And they're pretty much off the grid.
Yeah. It sounded like it. It sounded like mm-hmm. when they were, going through recycling everything. I mean, they even had like a human waste, you know, they're using it for fertilizer for their vegetables or whatever.
It's called humanure. And,
Humanure, yes.
I have some people I know in Indiana who use that. Yeah, they use everything.
But,
so,
I'm looking here in the chat room, and Sandy White said that all kids need to be taught critical thought, and that is a very large statement there. They do. All kids need to be taught to think for their own, not to go along with the zombie crowd just because, you know, everybody else is doing it. You know, everybody else is buying the latest electronic whatever, or, you know, that's the zombie crowd.
Well, that, and I mean, kids always are going to go through that, whatever, they want to identify with other kids, and,
they
need to rebel a bit, and all of this from the parents, and, you know, the wise parent sort of lets them, but they that doesn't mean they can't be taught critical thought. There's a lot of things I believe that we could be teaching in our schools. I have a friend who is just adamant that there needs to be some kind of courses taught, whether from budgeting to childcare, all of these things, relationships, and she says it needs to be in high school or maybe junior high start out, because parents aren't teaching their kids, and the churches, the ones that try, I mean, we know what, you know, that's a whole unreal thing. So somewhere kids need to get some of this, but critical thought would go along with this. There's just life tools that they need to be taught.
It is. I mean, they need to have the ability to separate dogma and slogan from facts and, you know, verified facts or whatever, and make a decision based on that, not on, you know, some sort of a group dogma or whatever that just keeps getting repeated, but there's nothing to base that what they're saying on. You know, it's just it's just because everybody's saying it, that's the reason I'm doing it. Or, you know,
exactly.
Needs to
well,
break
everybody's
that.
Doing it. Everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it.
Everybody's doing it. Yeah.
Or we've always done it.
Beta rock.
You know, we'll just keep doing it this way.
And that's,
you know, but we see that with adults and organizations, because it's the same with the churches, because something was put in a book 2,000 years ago. At the time, I mean, when you go back and think about it, you see the reason it was there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't apply now. One of my biggies is the whole thing when the churches get excited about gays, and they'll give you something from Leviticus, I think, about men not laying with men. Well, shit, you know, look way back. The world had very few people. They wanted to populate it. And if guys were with guys, they weren't going to be populating. Well, that made sense, okay? This is not necessarily the word of God. It made sense. It was pragmatic. Now we have two.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they combined a lot of rules that were necessary for their survival. You know, like, I guess, don't eat certain animals, because, you know, at the time, maybe certain animals had more possibility of giving you some sort of parasites or something like that. And, you know, and it makes sense then, or, you know, don't do this or don't do that. But you think about some of the rules, like, you know, don't have two separate types of cloth, or, you know, slaves, and you can stone your wife or something. You know, it's all stupid. But they tend to pick and choose what rules they want to emphasize their own biases.
That. Like, think about why that rule was made. And it made sense, sort of, then.
It did. It made sense for wandering tribes in the desert 2,000 years ago, but maybe not so much today, you know?
Yeah. So, there again, people need to be able to think. The ability's there. They need to do it. But we're not taught. We're not taught critical thinking. We're not even really taught that our opinion's valuable in school.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Many people are taught that.
As a matter of fact, you're sort of taught that if you have an individual opinion, that you're almost an outcast, or, you know, even maybe. I mean, it seems like words today can even maybe characterize you as a terrorist or a potential terrorist. You know, there's been instances where just mere words have caused people to be killed.
Yeah. So there's always that underlying fear.
Mm-hmm. There is.
And so I guess that the fear, Gwen talked about that on the show the other day, just that there's so much fear that people have. We're born into it now, it seems. It's not just, you know, I think of, like, the kids in Gaza that have, you know, they've been born with the drones, and they'll, you know, just continue that kind of thing. But it's not just like them. I mean, we are born into a certain fearsome society. They used to have the Cold War.
Yeah, fear of Reds everywhere, you know, communists and.
Right.
You know, fear is a very powerful social force.
For
keeping things in control. I mean, there's reasons for, you know, having enemies. You know, that's the one thing, is America has never been without an enemy, and there may be a reason for that. It's because enemies allow us to not think of the things that we normally would be thinking about and maybe get disgruntled about. You know, nobody talks about crumbling infrastructure when you got terrorists at every corner, you know.
Exactly.
Like,
and it gives you, the enemy in common. So then people can, you know, sort of bond together behind the military, kind of thing. And the fear, though, because now we have a lot of that going on, because it's just plain lies, but some of the ones in control, are really trying to divide people. Still, maybe I should say again, along the color lines and religion.
Religion, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, that's just an evil thing to do. Because
very evil. You know, I don't think people realize just how much conservative Christian movement that is just as strong as what they would call the Taliban in over there. I mean, we had our conservative religious movement here.
We've got
that is just as destructive. And, you know, they, you know, I could go, this could be a completely different show, but I could give you example after example where some of the statements that you just can't even imagine are being said in the year 2013, but, you know, these are the statements that people are saying that are actually in power. You know, some of the leaders of this country.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. No, you're right. We have our own Wahhabis. And, you know, because those people are, in my opinion, really crazy. But we've got ours. So, it's like you said, it's coming from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a few people off in some backwoods. I'm not saying
it's not. A lot of people that are in the military, a lot of people that are in top political positions, and, you know, they're actually believing this stuff. And I saw something just the other day where they were having a discussion a civil engineer was having a discussion with the commissioners in Miami, Florida, and one of the commissioners said that God wouldn't allow a flood to occur again. And, you know, how can you plan around climate change when you have people that are saying, you know, that God's in control of the flooding or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, and they're still doing battle for different kinds of textbooks that.
Yeah. Texas is. You know, you
have to throw in the Christian viewpoint as opposed to evolution and on and on. And just. So it's hard to get thinking, critical thinking.
Yeah, critical thinking. It all comes back to that. And I've even seen some of these religious groups attacking critical thinking, that, you know, it's causing,
yes,
like, yeah, disgruntlement and dissatisfaction, that you should, you know, it's like facts are getting in the way of your happiness, or, you know.
Right. Speak for yourself. You know, if women think for themselves, well, then the home life isn't going to be happy.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Okay. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and Sandy says that it seems that most religions value kindness. We mostly see extremists. And this is true. The core of all religions and spiritual paths, as far as I've seen, is kindness, compassion, love. But
I agree. Yeah.
So many people, and it's not just the extreme. I mean, they are extreme, but I think there's more of them than we really know. Because I've had people say some really stupid things to me about religion, and it's because they're encouraged to study it, but they're only encouraged to study what so-and-so says it means.
Yeah, the biases always come into the interpretation. That's right.
Yeah. You as far as to read it and study, to go research what was going on then, what was really happening in another part of the world at that time, they're not encouraged to do that at all.
Yeah, they're not even allowed to say, oh, you know, this was 2,000 years ago. Maybe there are some things that I can get out of this, but also have to say to myself that, look, this has been interpreted for this situation way back then. There's some wisdom in this, but maybe a lot of these things weren't so wise for the times today. And, you know, they're not allowed to adapt. They're sort of like, okay, you have to take everything as verbatim extreme, and we'll pick out what phrases we want to enforce.
Right. And we'll tell you exactly what that phrase means, what you might think. So the people don't even have the relationship with God that you would think that they would be looking for, because they have to have their relationship through what somebody else tells them it's supposed to be.
You're right. I mean, they don't look for religion for wisdom. They look for religion as enforcement, you know, enforcement of social norms. It's not to teach for them. It's to control.
Right. No, totally to control. It's not to enjoy the world and be grateful and help others enjoy and be grateful. No, you're right. It's just control.
More zombieism.
That's what I said. Hey, I mean, the zombie thing is pretty much everywhere, and not just in history. Goodness. Okay, our time is up. So David can be found at Roundtree 7 online, and also at thecommonsprojectnetwork.com.
All right, really fun show. I enjoyed it.
Well, we hit on a lot of things.
We did. We covered a lot of things.
Yeah. So thanks so much, David. And
thank you.
I'm sure we'll be talking soon. So watch some more of those wonderful fireworks.
I'm bandaging my thumb as we speak.
Well, think about it next time. That's all I can say. You do better with your work, with all your digits.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.